Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wader. In today's episode, supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, we had the pleasure of speaking with Guillermo Garcia Monero, MD, about research in myelodysplastic syndromes that was presented at the 2024 EHA Congress. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Garcia Monero discussed findings from a post-hoc analysis of the Phase 3 COMMANDS trial, evaluating the relationship between hemoglobin levels and quality of life in transfusion-dependent patients with lower-risk MDS receiving luspatercept or epoetin alpha. Real-world dose escalation outcomes among patients with lower-risk MDS receiving luspatercept, and multilineage and safety findings from the COMMANDS trial. Thank you, Dr. Garcia Monero, for joining us on an episode of Onc Live On Air. To start, what knowledge gaps or unmet needs did the post-hoc analysis of the COMMANDS trial aim to address?
So this presentation at EHA by Dr. Oliva was quite important. So over the last couple of years, we've seen three new indications for patients with lower risk MDS, two of them for luspatercept. And the main goal or primary endpoint of these clinical trials that led to the approval of, in this case, luspatercept, was improvement in hemoglobin. Now, the question is, what happens when you achieve that? And basically, do the patients feel better? So do they have any improvement in quality of life? So this was a very important presentation by Dr. Esther Oliva from Italy, who is an expert in this area. She's been working on this for a long period of time. And she utilized the COMMANDS study data. The COMMANDS, as the audience probably knows, is the Phase 3 randomized study comparing luspatercept versus an ESA. And there, basically, she used these PRO tools that have different domains to really relate this to increases in hemoglobin. So basically, what she showed is that those patients that had an improvement in hemoglobin actually had a benefit in terms of the reported PRO issues. And actually, what was more interesting was actually that this was more clear for those that had a hemoglobin increase over 1.5 grams and for those patients that achieve a hemoglobin over 10. So what this suggests is that indeed, actually, designing these trials with a goal of increasing hemoglobin should improve the quality of life and well-being of our patients. That, after all, is, you know, what we want as clinicians.
How do you think that these findings will inform clinicians' decision-making regarding the optimal hemoglobin target?
This actually sounds like easy to do, but it's quite complex. So indeed, actually, there are many variables that affect how we analyze this quality of life type of endpoints in clinical trials. And the reason is that when we do this in randomized study, of course, we have strict guidelines for transfusion. So for instance, in a prior study called Medalist, we were comparing luspatercept versus placebo, but then we were trying to achieve levels of hemoglobin that were kind of predetermined on the trial. So in a way, you were achieving that with transfusions, meaning that, I refer to hemoglobin levels that we were trying to do with the drug. So sometimes this is actually not as straightforward in clinical trials. So I think this is a really good example of that this indeed can be done in studies like this. So that's very important. It also suggests that we should really incorporate this clearly into all our trials for lower risk MDS. This is quite important. And that actually we need to learn about these implications, because as you are asking very nicely in your question, is what is the goal of hemoglobin? Is it just transfusion dependency? Is it 9, 10, 11? And of course, this has implications for a drug luspatercept, where there is a dose escalation schema where maybe one could aim for higher hemoglobin levels. Also, the analysis that I reported, the way I understood it, is agnostic for the drug. So it was not specifying whether this was for luspatercept or ESA. In that trial, patients were treated with either drug. So understanding difference between luspa and ESA, understanding these issues related to dose escalation will be quite important. So I think it's a very important first step.
Regarding the study on the real-world dose escalation and outcomes in lower-risk MDS with luspatercept, what is the importance of assessing the impact of dose escalation on real-world clinical benefit with this agent?
As the audience should know, the way we administer and the way luspatercept is approved is following a dose escalation schema. So you start with 1 mg/kg, and the drug is given every 3 weeks, right? So you give a couple of doses, and if there's no response, then you can go to 1.33, and then you can go on to 1.75. That's the cap dose. That was actually determined, my understanding is, by the FDA, and it's a little bit of a safety issue, saying, okay, so if we go too high on the hemoglobin, that of course we would like to see in a majority of our patients, this could be potentially detrimental, because if you had uncontrolled erythrocytosis with hemoglobins or, you know, 20 grams or something like that, maybe our patients will have strokes or some type of complications. Unfortunately, you know, we are never able to get these levels that high in myelodysplastic syndrome, but it's a safety concern. And of course, we need to follow the guidelines of the FDA. So here the question actually is, how many patients are actually dose escalated and what is the impact? So this real world analysis shows that a majority of the patients, around 85% of them, were dose escalated. So this means that the first dose, the 1 milligram, maybe is not the most effective way to start, and that perhaps at some point, the sponsor of these trials and the authorities should reconsider this issue. Like, should we start at 1.33? Is 1.75 actually the highest dose that we can really administer? So that is actually, my understanding is that it's being evaluated in a couple of clinical trials where they're looking at higher doses of luspatercept up front. I think one study is called Maximus. So it will be interesting to know whether actually instead of one, we could go directly to 1.33, and whether actually in the future we could go and escalate up beyond that. So what this data is telling you is that one may not be a very effective way to use this drug. And, you know, one actually has to think about costs of the drug, cost of transfusions, and you could maybe skip this and go directly. I think we need more data, but this kind of data strongly suggests that this really needs to be investigated. This data will not support us switching our practice and starting 1.33, but I think gives ideas to people that do clinical research in this area in terms of new trial design and perhaps discussions with authorities in terms of what is the most efficient and still safe dose of this compound. So very important data. It also actually shows very interesting things. It shows that this dose escalation is important not only in transfusion-dependent patients, but there was a cohort of patients here that were transfusion-independent. This is interesting because, of course, the label of the drug is for patients that are candidates for transfusion. So you could have, let's say, hemoglobin of 8. You never receive a transfusion, but you're a candidate for transfusion. So in a way, the drug could be started early. And it appears that actually those patients that were transfusion independent indeed benefited also from the dose escalation. That is quite intriguing and something that we really need to understand better. Very important data, actually.
What was the rationale for assessing the impact of luspatercept on erythroid neutrophil and platelet lineages and its safety in the FLANCE trial?
When these drugs were designed, they were thought to be erythroid maturating agents, and they're thought to act a little bit kind of in the later steps of red cell formation. I was not anticipating any effect on white cells or platelets. I remember very well in one of the SOHO meetings a few years ago, someone asked either Dr. Verma or Platzbecker, who are leaders in this field, whether you could see these responses. And I was kind of curious about this question. But the reality is that when we did the Medalist trial, we saw those responses. Now, that study was against placebo, and it was kind of almost a curiosity, but we saw that there was not only the increase in hemoglobin, but also increase in platelets and increase in the white cells. So we saw bilineal and trilineage responses. So it's actually just logical to ask the same question in the COMMANDS trial. So what we saw here actually is that we saw the same, that basically if you look at HIE, that is hematological improvement erythroid, it was like 74% for luspatercept, 53% for ESA. Neutrophil was 33% versus 25%. Platelets were 42% versus 30%. The HIE is very significant because that's the erythroid level that is kind of endpoint of the study. But these patients, as the audience very well know, are not always cytopenic, meaning they always have anemia, but they may or may not have neutropenia, may or may not have thrombocytopenia. So the number of patients are maybe not enough to show a statistical significance. But basically, numerically, there is a clear trend that luspatercept improves platelet counts and may improve neutrophil count in patients with lower risk disease. So that's very interesting. I will take this as follows. I will take it that this drug doesn't cause cytopenia, so it's quite safe. So that is very clear. And I think that data at face value, even if these p-values are not significant, is very clear. So it does not induce neutropenia. It will not induce thrombocytopenia. I think the next question is, why does this happen? Do these drugs have another role beyond what we think now just in terms of erythropoiesis? So that's actually quite interesting. So the message is, this is safe, it may improve a little bit the platelet count and neutrophil count, and hopefully in the future we'll understand better why this happens.
What additional research has these findings inspired?
Yes, so we have a study ongoing here at MD Anderson where we are actually enrolling patients with low-risk MDS that, in addition to anemia, they have significant other cytopenia, like thrombocytopenia or neutropenia. And we are interested on understanding, actually, the dynamics on changes in platelet count and white count. So we selected a population that is more cytopenic than the typical population that goes into, let's say, the COMMANDS trial and the other studies. So that will allow us to better visualize this bilineal or trilineage effect. This study that is an investigator-initiated trial supported by BMS and conducted here at MD Anderson is a single-arm trial where we are analyzing the effects of luspatercept in different cohorts of patients. So one cohort of patients is low-risk MDS transfusion independent. Second cohort of patients is transfusion-dependent low-risk MDS. The main difference compared to, for instance, COMMANDS or maybe the ELEMENTS trial, that is two ongoing multicenter trials, is that these patients are required to have an additional cytopenia. And our interest is actually to basically monitor this phenomenon that we just discussed earlier in terms of the potential effect of this drug on platelets and neutrophil. Each cohort accrues around 20 patients, and we also have designed a quite ambitious correlative analysis looking at single-cell RNA-seq profiling to really understand what happens at the molecular level when we give these drugs.
Overall, where do you see the MDS treatment paradigm headed?
I think we're seeing a lot of progress all of a sudden. A lot of it is coming in low-risk disease, but I'm seeing some improvement in high-risk disease as well. So we saw the luspatercept approved in second line, now in first line. We just heard the approval of imetelstat in second line. There's a potent drug called KER-050 going into phase 3 trials. We heard the study from Spain, the Sintra Rep trial with a transfusion-dependent Del5Q minus MDS with low-dose lenalidomide, data with the oral HMAs in low-risk MDS. So I think we're doing very well all of a sudden in low-risk MDS. And of course, to see this data, for instance, from Dr. Patel poster in real world with this kind of activity is quite satisfactory. Seeing the data from Dr. Oliva in terms of the improvement in quality of life, very satisfactory. High-risk disease, of course, we are waiting for something that will improve the survival of our patients. So we're all waiting for this Verona trial, the combination with venetoclax. But we've done quite a bit of work with the oral hypomethylating agent. So my group led the development of oral decitabine cetazuridine, approved now in MDS. And actually, thanks to this work also in acute myelogenous leukemia in Europe. And we have shown very potent combinations between oral decitabine, venetoclax, in this so-called total oral therapy. And we're starting to see quite a bit of improvement in transplant outcomes in MDS. So I think we are in a very good direction, better than we were like 3 or 4 years ago. I forgot to mention also targeted approaches, for instance, recent approval of IDH1 inhibitor ivosidenib in a relapse refractory MDS, and now these drugs being tested actually in frontline trials. We have similar data with IDH2 inhibitors, although maybe not formalized on studies. So I think we're starting to gain momentum. We have major needs, targeting P53, HMA failures. You know, at TIHA, we saw a couple of disappointing stories with sabatolimab and magrolimab, but I think we are actually making quite a bit of progress.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Onc5 On Air, supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onc5.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Onc5 is also on social media. On X, follow us at Onc5. On Facebook, like us at Onc5, and follow our Onc5 page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Onc5 On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc5 On Air.